Hiya and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwini and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
Thank you for returning to listen to part two of this interview. I imagine that you, in your day-to-day practice, will work as part of a multidisciplinary team and, you know, looking at sort of what somebody wants to achieve and what each component of that team can bring to achieve that kind of jigsaw puzzle, I guess.
Certainly, in my time working with brain injury, I think working with other professionals is just so important. And there's lots of points of overlap as well. And what's really important that is that the team work together for that client-centered goal. And that's really collaborative. And that's a really lovely way to work for everybody, for the therapists involved and also for the client. And I always say to the clients I'm working with that they're part of the team, the same as anybody else is. Therapy, I don't think, should be something that's done to a person, very much collaborative, and that the client is so important in that team. But yeah, you're right. So often I've worked with, for example, I work with a physiotherapist and we're looking at somebody who wants to learn how to play pool and darts again following a brain injury. And that's very much a joint goal. And also, again, you know, often a lot of community work with speech and language therapy and neuropsychology as well. Obviously depends on the client's goal, but I think that sort of liaison and close working with other professionals is so important. And you know, you've kind of got overriding client goals, and then, like I say, every professional will break those down into smaller goals, but the important thing is that they all link together like a jigsaw puzzle. And at the end of it, we're all working towards the same aim.
Yeah. And how do you, I mean, you know, obviously clients will have their goals and sometimes things will come into play that mean that those goals, for whatever reason, cannot be achieved. How do you sort of manage that?
If it doesn't happen for whatever reason, then I suppose that there are certain points where you would get to a point where you'd say, OK, well, we haven't achieved this goal, but then what's to stop us resetting that as a goal? So I can think of an example where a client's maybe had six goals and they're all, you know, they're all equally important. I want to do all of these things, Julie. But actually, when we've got into therapy, four of them's been achieved, but two hasn't. But that's not to say we haven't made headway in those goals and that some of the steps aren't there. So then I suppose that's about having that discussion and saying, well, is it still important? Do we want to reset it? And that'll be the focus for, say, the next 6 months.
Yeah.
So I think if you get the balance right, and that's the skill of that sort of collaborative work and client-centered goals, is getting the goal flavor right, getting the, you know, setting the tone right. Is this achievable in the time that we've got realistically?
I guess also focusing on the positives, focusing on what has been achieved, and, you know, think back to, you know, 5-6 months ago when you weren't doing that, and look at what you've managed to do.
I think that's really the benefit of writing sort of goals, client-centered goals over sort of impairment goals. Because you've got space to say, yeah, OK, so we didn't achieve what we thought we were going to achieve. So say, for example, Brooke said to me, Julie, I want to cook 5 meals this week from fresh. And we only got to 3. That's still really impressive. And you've got the space to say, well, actually, look what you have achieved, because this time 6 months ago, you couldn't do 1 meal and now you can do 3. Do you want to reset it to do 5, or, you know, do you want to focus on something else? So I think there's always space to focus on the positive elements of that.
I think it's important to like record your progress so you can look back, because I suppose having a brain injury, your memory gets all messed up. And it's particularly when you see yourself every day, you don't notice the small, you know, improvement that you make every day. You just, one thing that somebody said to me that I wish I'd have done was to video myself speaking, because I remember there was one incident, walking in Scarborough Main Street, and I'd seen somebody I know walking towards me, and I'd actually dived in the shop because I dared have a conversation with them, because I used to stammer all the time, used to stutter all the time. And I just see the progress that I've made from that. And, you know, if I've gone from that to speaking at the Safe Drive, Stay Alive in front of 500 people, you just, but you don't notice it the day by day.
I think, Brooke, you've completely exceeded whatever that goal was that we set before you jumped into service to avoid that person by doing podcasts and speaking in front of all of those people. But that's exactly right, isn't it? So we could set a goal to improve your stamina or confidence, but what's really meaningful is to review that and say, were you able to walk down the street and speak to people without diving into servers for cover? Yes, you've achieved that goal, isn't that really? And it's attaching it to something that's really meaningful to you.
Yeah, I think the ability to look back, like particularly whenever the same thing, you know, you'd see yourself day by day and you'd not see any progress. But if I'd see somebody that I haven't seen for a year, there would be staggered at how progress I've made, but you yourself don't notice that, and it's gives yourself a boost to notice that.
I think you're right, Brooke, and I think if you get goals right and you sit down together and write those goals and then review them, and if it's 6 months be able to look back and see where you were, then that's really a powerful motivator, because you're right, you see yourself in the mirror every day and you don't notice the little things. And it's only when you sit down and review it that you say, actually, look what I was doing 6 months ago and look what I can do now.
And I think like in the very early days, I mean, you probably change week on week, don't you? You know, month by month. And then obviously as you hit that plateau, it slows down. But I think you do continue to make improvements if you want to.
I think the other thing that happens is that you learn to cope with sort of impairments that might still be there or things that you can't do. You learn to adapt and use the strategies more. And like I said about the fatigue management, you know, you probably still find fatigue an issue. However, you have lots of strategies in your toolbox that you know you can go to that help you to do everything that you're doing now and having a really productive and meaningful life. And it's not that the fatigue's changed, it's that you've changed and you can use all of those strategies and tools independently to help.
Have you ever had like a situation where you've had someone who's just a wildly unachievable or unrealistic goal for themselves, but they've been kind of really determined that that's what they want to do? And again, how do you sort of manage that?
Oh, that's a really good question, isn't it? I don't know that I've ever had anyone set a goal that was so unrealistic that it was never going to happen. I think I've had clients who've come to me with goals that I've thought, oh my goodness, I'm not sure that's going to happen. And I guess that's where you work really closely with the team around you, like your neuropsychologists. Again, it's that skill of being able to sit with a person and break down why that goal's not happening anywhere, to look at the barriers for that and to set small steps to see how far you go. But I guess that's about managing expectation as well. And again, insight. Don't think I'm speaking from experience here, but I could see it being a situation where you would be working closely with a neuropsychologist to look at somebody's insight and realistic expectations and managing that in a safe space. So I think I'm fairly lucky in that that's not been my experience so far. But there again, I suppose I can think, for example, driving after brain injury is can be quite a challenging goal. But again, it's not for me to say whether or not that would be possible in most instances. It would be about supporting that person to break that down into smaller goals and to keep checking in at every step. And then again, as a team, helping that client to manage that expectation and insight to see if that's becoming a realistic goal.
I think I've certainly seen it with clients where, you know, they've wanted to go back to work, which is, you know, perfectly normal. A lot of people want to, but perhaps, you know, returning to what they were doing before, which might be unachievable given the way their brain injury has impacted them. And so again, as you say, it's about working with the other clinicians, looking at insight, breaking things down. Well, you know, let's not go back to the high powered job straight away. Let's start with doing this, doing that. And as you say, like, you know, the fatigue management comes into it as well. And just all those other aspects, trying to sort of facilitate somebody to get to the next step. And let's keep reviewing it. Let's keep seeing what, you know, let's keep reflecting on the progress that's been made. And actually, do we still want to be going in that direction? Or do we want to change tack a little bit? So I guess it's all part of the journey, isn't it? It just, that journey is made up of many steps, and it might be that sometimes the path changes or meanders off a little bit.
That's exactly right. And again, it's about the achievable and realistic goal setting process. So, I mean, that's such a big goal after brain injury to go back to work and think, you know, as a team, we'd be looking to break that down into a much smaller goal around sort of pre-vocational skills, for example, which is, you know, being able to get up at a set time, get dressed, manage medication, cook for yourself, all of those things. And then following that, you know, I've had clients, we've worked on sort of volunteering programs to sort of practice those work skills. Again, just broken the goals down to you, so you get more of a feeling of where the overall goal will be. But I guess you wouldn't set that as the main goal immediately because it's much more complex.
I think you imagine that you can do much more than you can as well. Like I imagined, I guess, back out in a nightclub, I'd have this great story to tell. I'd be really like charismatic, you know, speak to loads of people. And then the first time that was put to the test was I used to work in a bar and we sort of arranged a day where it was the quietest day of the week. I've told this story before, but music was on really low and a few of my workmates. I remember sat there and like, obviously, you know, a big thing had happened to me. Loads of people wanted to speak to me and I was just, it just totally, completely exhausted me. And from, you know, from what I thought I would be this really charismatic, you know, holding court, speaking to everyone. And what in reality, what actually happened was I crumbled. And that was really like a knock to my confidence.
Mm. And how would you manage that then? Like,
you need to prepare people for that.
Yeah. Like, you know, if somebody does sort of overstretch a little bit and then it does have that impact on confidence or motivation, it must be quite difficult for that person to accept what's changed. And, you know, it's that realization that things aren't going to return to, in inverted commas, normal. And, you know, it's sort of managing and resetting expectations, I guess, and preventing depression.
They will be thinking about, you know, restarting work, and they will be drawing on memories that they had of, you know, they won't have any memories of them having a brain injury. They don't have memories of them when they used to go to work. So they think they'd just be able to go and, you know, and just carry on with the job. But then when you do something with a brain injury for the first time, it can be really shocking and really, yeah, quite depressing.
Yeah, I imagine. And I suppose that question's probably best directed to maybe a neuropsychologist. But I'm thinking about in that scenario, I'd be thinking that we should have maybe practiced some of those skills in a safer place and tried to sort of grade that. So in some respect, experiential learning is really important, because I guess that gave you some insight into some of the things you were struggling with. And then that might have helped you to say, right, my neuropsychologist or Julie, this happened to me. What can I do so it doesn't happen again? Whereas before then, you would never have said to us, this is a goal, because you'd have thought, I don't need that setting as a goal. I'm fine. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do this. In some respects, insight is really important. But what we don't want is, like you said, you don't want that to be such a negative experience. It has an effect on mood, or it has an effect on engagement. So it's about, I guess that's the beauty of, if you get therapy right and you're working in a team that's right for that client, is that's a safe space to practice those things and to build it up. And that's, again, where the grading comes in. So, you know, you build up to that situation, but you have lots of practices in a safe space. And again, the other thing is fatigue management. You know, if we'd looked at what happened the day before or a couple of days before, it could be that that wasn't the optimum time for that to happen for you, because you were already sort of fatigued. There's lots of positives still to draw out of that, and there's lots of opportunity for therapy within that. You just have to be really careful that you are providing a safe space for people. And often that does happen, you know, where somebody's insight into their difficulties increases, and then that affects their mood because that realization of, oh, actually, I'm not good at this anymore, and actually, I do need help for this.
It impacts on identity, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's certainly, I know that I've worked with neuropsychologists, and that's been a really important goal for them, working with my client around that new sense of identity and that acceptance of the brain injury, and, you know, that change that's occurred.
I guess a journey of 1,000 miles really does start with a single step. And or lots of steps. graded in a safe way. Thank you very much for talking to us today. It's also been really nice from my perspective getting a bit more of an insight into Brooke's life and recovery.
Something I don't remember a lot now.
But it's also just really nice to see that, you know, he's obviously clearly had an impact on you in as much as you've had an impact on him. So, thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.